Hillside is less than a month away, and in case you forgot to buy your tickets, don't worry. Single-day tickets are still available for Friday, July 25th and Sunday, July 27th. Come be part of an engaging weekend of music, art, community, and celebration featuring artists such as Tegan and Sarah, Fortet, Baja Bulat, Hey Rosetta, various spoken word performers, children's music, neighborhood organizations, craft and food vendors, workshops, and much, much more. Tickets are available online at www.ticketbreak.ca and also at retailers across Southern Ontario, such as The Bookshelf and The Beat Goes On here in Guelph, Soundscapes in Toronto, and Encore Records in Kitchener. Hillside is a physically accessible event. Get your tickets before they are gone, as you do not want to miss out on this year's Hillside experience.
Creative Control with Vish Khanna.
On the program today, my old friend Charles Austin from Halifax, Nova Scotia joins me ostensibly to talk about the Super Friends, although we didn't talk that much about the Super Friends, come to think of it. We talked about other stuff, Al Tuck, the Ramones, the Wiggles, Jen Grant, Paper Beat Scissors, a whole bunch of stuff, Monomyth. It's good. Super Friends playing in Guelph, very rare show for at the Hillside Festival, so that's why Charles and I decided to have this chat and share with you. So enjoy. This week, the Bookshelf Cinema is screening Words and Pictures, The Immigrant, Don Giovanni, The Fault in Our Stars, The Grand Seduction, and more. On Thursday, July 24th, The Medicine Hat, Shopkeeper, and Milk and Honey play the E-Bar. The Bookshelf is an independently owned culture hub located at 41 Quebec Street in Guelph. Visit bookshelf.ca for more information. Charles Austin lives in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and is one of the best musicians, producers, and people that I know. Austin has played in bands and projects like Noisyland, The Lodge, Lost Wax Guild, Aqua Alta, and Psychic Fair, and he's also collaborated with Buck 65 and Al Tuck, among others. He first gained prominence in the mid-1990s when his band, the Super Friends, became underground favorites, releasing three killer albums and some EPs and singles, and touring the continent as headliners, but also frequently opening for people like Sloan and Guided by Voices. Their landmark debut album, 1995's Mock-Up Scale Down, was issued on vinyl for the first time last year, and after years of inactivity, the band is playing select shows, including one at the Hillside Festival in Guelph on Saturday, July 26th. Here to discuss this further is Charles Austin. Hey, Charles, how are you?
Good, Vish. Good, Yeah, pretty. You're saying select is pretty select. I think that's the only show that we're. It's very selective.
Yeah, I don't know how Guelph was selected, but it's great that we got selected. That's good.
No, it's great that we got asked to do it. So we were trying to do like a miniature kind of tour around that, but it's really hard for people of our kind of advanced age to schedule things like this, so it was the only one that we could do because of everyone's really kind of busy. So
yeah, but yeah. And then, like, as far as I know, you played when the sort of around the reissue time, which I don't even know if the reissue was ready, but you played like Toronto,
yeah,
and then you played Halifax, and I think that was pretty much it.
Yeah, we did two. Yeah, in the last I don't want to say 10 years, it's probably like 7 or 8 years we played those three shows. We went to Toronto to play the Murder Records 20th anniversary show, but the reissue wasn't ready for that. It took a while for the thing to get to come out. So that was for that Murder Records book.
Yeah.
The with the single. This is kind of a rare occasion in this. And I know that you've alluded in other conversations I've had with you. We've talked about drummer problems, and in this, well, hopefully it's not going to be a problem, but we've had to recruit a youth to play this show in Guelph. And I'm going to meet him and play with him. I must have met him before, but his name's Kieran Adams.
Yeah.
He's playing drums.
Yeah, he plays in Diana, too.
Yeah, I guess Matt says he's a great drummer. I've heard he's really good, and he used to play with Ben Gunning, so I'm not really too worried about that. But unfortunately, Dave Marsh, who's been playing like drums in the last bunch of shows, his brother is getting married the day of the Guelph show, and he was getting a lot of family pressure to be. Obviously, that wasn't something he could miss. So
yeah, no, it's unfortunate, yeah. But thanks for the explanation. I wondered what was going on because Dave, in a lot of ways, is the Super Friends glue.
Well, he's kind of an important. It's weird. Like we had two kind of long time drummer. Well, maybe three, but Dave and Lonnie James were definitely like the ones that really kind of define the records because they played on the record. So they're in a weird Dave style kind of really suits the band because he's got a lot of like classic influences, but he's also kind of, you know, he can do a lot of Keith Moon kind of Topper Heaton, I guess is how you say his last name.
Mm-hmm. From the Clash.
The Clash. Yeah, I mean, he's kind of synthesized all those styles, so he's kind of really good for us. And you know, Lonnie had the kind of crazy, almost more of a punky kind of energy, but that was also really good. So one of those guys, and it kind of has to be one of those guys pretty much for it to be, for the recording. So I think this Kieran fellow, from what I've heard, is going to be really good. So I'm kind of excited, actually, about trying to play the songs with somebody else because you kind of reinvent them as you go.
Yeah, no,
and they're pretty old.
Yeah, Kieran's great. That's great. So you're going to meet, you're playing this Saturday and you have not met your drummer yet.
No, I'm going to meet him on Thursday. We actually had to switch our flights. Like the thing about these songs, like when you play them like a couple hundred times, they are, it's a disgusting term, but the term is muscle memory.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, they really are kind of ingrained in your, just like the patterns and stuff are pretty ingrained. So then you just kind of brush up on that and it's usually good. But I mean, with a different drummer, there's going to be subtle things that are going to kind of change, can maybe reinvent it a bit or just play a little differently. So that's, I don't know. I'm looking forward to it. I don't know. Maybe I'll be freaking out like the day of the show or something like that because I haven't, you know, played a show with the band in a year and a half, but I don't know. I'm sure it'll be fine.
Kieran,
you gotta roll with it.
You do. Kieran is in Dawson City as you and I are speaking right now. His band Diana, they're up at the Dawson City Music Festival. So not only is he going to have to come back and learn a bunch of songs he's never played before, he's got to adjust to like sun, like moon, nighttime, I guess. I was going to say sunlight, but he's going to have to like reacclimatize himself to so many things at the same time. It's an amazing challenge you put forth for this young man.
Yeah, well, I guess it wouldn't really be in the spirit of the band if it was any other way. It just seems like these kind of things happen. And, you know, we had this originally Drew, who lives in Halifax, Drew Yamato, the other guitar player besides Matt Murphy, he and I were going to come in on a Friday morning, and I got an email from Matt and said, that's a big problem. And I was like, oh, yeah, why? It's like, Kieran won't be here, or he has to leave in the afternoon. So we literally wouldn't have had a chance to practice with the guy. So that, you know, I'm really glad that we're going in Thursday. We can have a long rehearsal Thursday night and Friday morning and just kind of get things worked out.
Right. All right. Well, I'm looking forward to, I mean, it's good to have the context of what's going to happen. I'm looking forward to it no matter what. So that's cool.
It'll be entertaining no matter what.
Now, are you in Halifax right now as we're speaking?
Yeah.
So what's the latest news in Halifax? What's everyone kind of talking about right now?
Like bands and stuff?
No, actually,
or just in general.
General. I know there was a hurricane kind of thing happening recently. Did that have a huge impact on the city?
Oh yeah. There was a lot of falling trees. It was pretty crazy. I was actually going that day. I felt kind of weird about it, but I had Mike O'Neill and Mike Gladenberg and I went to play a show in PEI that day, so I kind of left the city and we drove to PEI and I got my family here, but it wasn't like Hurricane Juan. It wasn't crazy, but it was there were a lot of people who lost power, but we were driving to PEI and the wind was insane. But we got there and we played this club, awesome club in, or place to play in PEI called the Trailside Cafe, which is run by Pat. You must know Pat Dean, or you heard of Pat Dean, who does Strawberry. He's been Strawberry and a bunch of these other bands. Anyway, he's got a great, if people are looking for a place to play in PEI, this is a great place to play, Trailside.
The Trailside, okay.
Yeah, and they put you up, and they feed you, like, really, really good food. And we played a show there with a band called Mardeen, Mike O'Neill band, which is Mike and myself and Mike Clyburn on drums, and then Mardeen played.
Nice.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah, so it was worth the brave and the hurricane for that.
So Halifax was impacted, but people are recovering.
It's not like Hurricane Juan. It's not like that kind of thing which that was crazy, you know, like no power for, you know, 3 or 4 days. It wasn't like that here in Halifax.
How long ago was Hurricane Juan?
I think it was around 2004.
Oh,
but,
okay.
Yeah, it was pretty nuts. But we seem to be getting more of them. Maybe not of the same severity, but we're getting definitely more hurricanes. And you never really know what to think, right? You don't know if it's going to be crazy or it's just going to be like a heavy downpour. So there's like 3 or 4 of them every year now, and it's definitely it's getting. I don't know if it's. Probably you can attribute it to climate change, but it is definitely there's been a lot more in the last few years than, you know, the last 10 years previous. So
yeah, you've been in Halifax like over 20 years, right?
Yeah, a long time now. Yeah, so I don't really know what else is going on. I'm trying to think of interesting. You know, there's a bunch of the same thing as usual. There's a bunch of new. There's good. Like young bands that keep coming up and then breaking up or, you know, trying to do something. And there's, I think you talked to that band Monomyth a while ago. Mm-hmm. Those guys are, one of the more kind of interesting bands around right now. I'm kind of excited about their record coming out. And there's another band called Walrus who are really good. And, yeah, so there's a bunch of stuff going on. I don't know if it really always travels much out of, I guess, Monomyth kind of because they're on Mint, people kind of hear about them, but, you know, it's pretty much the same, just like people in bands and the people in 5 different bands and
everyone's in a billion different bands, right?
Yeah, and like not a lot of venues, you know, and just the same kind of a lot of house shows these days.
What's going on with the venues? I thought, the last time I was in Halifax was for the Pop Explosion. And,
yeah,
you know, you're running around all the different venues. It seemed like things were going on.
You know, but like this, the Seahorse has like also has a dance kind of thing that starts at midnight. So that's one I went to see Evan Dando play there a month or two ago. It was a great show, but right at midnight, you know, pulsating dance music started, like no exceptions. So it's that kind of thing. Like they're trying to figure out ways to generate revenue. You know, the Marquee is not really open that often, just like special events. So there's basically like Gus's and the Seahorse, and there's a little kind of grimy, awesomely grimy club called Jacobs in Dartmouth.
Oh,
which is more of a punk kind of club, I guess. Like there's a bunch of bands around that scene over there in Dartmouth. It's a little grittier than Halifax. It's pretty fun. Like a little hole in the wall basement where you just, you know, you you have a shoebox and you collect $5 and 5 bands play that kind of club. It's right. It's pretty cool.
And you're making it out to shows still? Like, I mean, you're a guy who works in a recording studio, I presume almost every day. Is that right?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. No. Yeah. I still try. Well, you know, it's hard cause I have to get up early. So that kind of puts the kibosh on a lot of it, but I do still try to go see. I go see a lot of the bands that I work with just because I kind of want to get a sense of what they're doing, and then you have the release show, but too. So yeah, there's a bunch of bands around, like this band I'm recording called the Scoop Outs, who are kind of like very grungy, really good songs, kind of like very, oh, well, their favorite band is the Me Puppets, and that's one of my favorite bands, too, so we really get along on that, you know, musically.
Yeah, they're called the Scoop Outs.
Yeah, they're really good. When they're on, they're super on. When they're off, it's kind of like, you know, actually, when I saw them, it kind of reminded me of what, you know, what I imagine seeing the Replacements like would have been like when they're either super on or super, you know, just a shambles. But when they're on, they're great. So that's one band I'm really excited about. But,
okay, the Scoop Outs. I'll keep an eye out for them. Now, what?
Yeah,
you actually worked today, right? Were you in the studio today?
Yeah. It was pretty muggy. I use that word again. I'm going to go back tonight. Like generally, I do, you know, there's a lot of like people just kind of doing small projects and it's kind of what I found is a lot of the time I'll be working on things like a little sporadically over the course of, you know, 6 months, you'll spend like 3 hours here, 3 hours there. So it's a lot of little projects, which is cool. And then sometimes my Graham Campbell, the Gray Matter, like the guy I do some of the Buck 65 stuff with, we'll get like a little TV soundtrack or film soundtrack thing, and that'll kind of like take some energy for a few weeks. So there's that too. So it's just trying to keep it's a bit of a hustle, you know, as you can imagine. It's mm-hmm. just like, you know, working it's a labor of love and a bit of a hustle, but you know, if I didn't like it, I'm going to go back tonight at 7 for a couple hours, but you know, I like this stuff I'm working on, so not quite as painful.
Yeah. the thing you worked on today, was that your own thing or were you working with somebody else?
No, that was a guy named, Tim Crabtree. He's got a thing called Paper Beat Scissors.
Mm-hmm.
It's got like, he's done some stuff with, Snail, Mike Fierstek and a bunch of he's actually plays a lot in Europe, and we're just doing some guitar overdubs and stuff on his record, and it's sounding really good. He did a bunch of drums with Nathan Doucette. I don't know if you know who that guy is, the drummer from, he'd be known for Yellow Jacket Avenger.
Oh, yeah?
Ross. Cool. Really good drummer, really cool drummer, and so there's a bunch of drum tracks we're overdubbing on. And
wait, he's not in Crosses, is he?
Yeah, he is.
That guy's phenomenal. That's a great drummer right there. Nathan Doucette. Yeah,
he's great. Yeah, he's amazing. Yeah, and so he's kind of like, he now is kind of the point where people get him to play on their records. You know, people would find out that this guy was really, really good at specific. You know, he's really good at like that kind of heavier, like Crosses type stuff. And he's good. He's pretty versatile. So he's a great drummer. So it's cool to see people actually like hiring him to play on their records, and he's really, you know, easy to work with. So there's guys like that, you know, there's a bunch of like new blood where you get these people who are consistently on different people's records. So I really like that too. You know, you get to know who's good at what and you get to work with them. And
yeah, no. And Tim's really cool. I met Tim at Lanya Vanya in St. John's last year.
Oh, okay. Yeah. No, he's really, really good. He's an amazing finger picker. So it's, just watching him play these guitar parts. I don't know what you'd liken it to. It's kind of a little bit Radiohead-ish or something.
Yeah.
The stuff he's doing. It's pretty, you know, but the, you know, it's just like, you know, when you're, you can kind of be, it's kind of humbling, you know, when you see people doing something really well, like when you're recording music, often when you work with people who are really good players, it's kind of humbling too, because it kind of puts it in perspective too.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Now I listed off a bunch of things that you've done, and some of them are things you're doing. What are your current sort of active Halifax musical projects, Charles?
Well, the band that we're Psychic Fair, that band's it's kind of more like, you know, old timers hockey when guys kind of like lace up their skates once a week and then they go out and. It's kind of like that. Like, it's kind of like, yeah, I played in the OHL and I'm still into it kind of thing. So we do, that's Cliff Gibb from Thresh Hermit, the drummer.
Uh-huh.
And Andrew Glencross, I played with for a long time. He plays bass, but he used to play keys in that Noisy Land band. So,
mm-hmm.
And then we got this, the new blood. We've got Josh Salter from Monomyth on vocals. So kind of like trying to co-opt like the younger generation, you know, kind of almost in a vampiric kind of way, like, you know, that kid's got a lot of energy, he's got a really cool voice, let's get him to sing. So we got him. Josh actually knows a ton about like obscure stuff from our era or my era, so it's good. Like he can reference something, he knows what you're talking about. So.
Totally, yeah. Like I he was on, as you mentioned, Josh also plays in Monomyth, and he was on the show a little while ago, and yeah, when I got to talk to him, he knew lyrics to songs that I kind of would just reference, you know, just barely mention a song, and he would just know all the words, and like, yeah, clearly like a huge student of music, that kid.
Like a scholar, yeah, and like he'd be like, oh, what, you know, what about the Only Ones, and I know like one song, he's like, oh, the second record's really good, third record's okay, you know, like that kind of thing, like he knows, oh, like stuff that I don't know how he could possibly know that much about that stuff, that he, I don't know, it's kind of weird, actually.
Yeah, he's like, but, I think yeah. That's all he does. He's from Hubly, Nova Scotia, and I got the impression there's not a whole ton to do there.
Yeah, that's the way he spins it. Yeah, and I think they also have the, like, maybe from the internet generation where it's like, oh, okay, well, I really like, you know, Husker Du, so Google that, and then it's like, oh, you know, Squirrel Bait and
yeah,
Volcano Suns, and you know what I mean? Like, they can find out this information that might have used to be pretty hard to access, or you'd have to, like, scour through some, like, Forced Exposure magazine or something. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like they can find out this stuff. Like some kid in like Hubly or rural Cape Breton can find out everything about, you know, whatever band.
Yeah, like everyone's records are all on YouTube. You can find everything. I don't know why we're talking like we just discovered something that everybody.
<It's> crazy. I mean, I do miss the feeling of buying some and not knowing what it was going to be. Like, you know, I remember reading that Sonic Youth sounded like REM. And I was a big REM fan, so I wouldn't buy it, like, Evol or something. I was like, what the hell is this? And then, of course, in retrospect, it's like, oh, it's, you know, it's really great, but it's nothing like REM, except yeah. It might be a bit droney or something. I don't know.
That's weird. That's weird that I had never heard those two. I mean, they obviously have some degrees of separation and have played with each other. You know, I think Sonic Youth opened an REM tour once or something.
Yeah. Yeah, but it was weird because like that would have been like 1983 or 1984. And it's like this is a new band that's kind of got some guitar in it, so it's like, and that's before REM were like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like they were just another big college band or something. And
yeah, so Psychic Fair is one of your projects. Anything else going on?
Well, that Graham and I, aforementioned Graham Campbell, we did a bunch of. Songs with the singer named Jen Grant, like singer-songwriter here, who we kind of met working with Rich Trefry. So we met her a couple years ago. So we just did, we've got like about like a 10-song record that I think is actually going to get put out just by like a little label. Dream pop stuff called Aqua Alta. It's just like my idea of what, or, you know, it's very collaborative, but I was kind of like, oh, okay, well, what if, you know, a band like Opal, you know, I don't know if you remember Opal, but like yeah. Later became like Mazzy Star or whatever. Like what if you wrote a bunch of cool instrumentals and had a female singer, like someone who was really into singing as opposed to like a reluctant dude.
Right.
So that's kind of the idea behind that. It's like, okay, well just get someone to sing who really, really likes to sing and can write. She can write all these different melodies. She's really good at writing crazy melodies. So, yeah, so we did, but that's taken a really long time to finish just because of everybody being in different places. And it's a kind of a strange record. I don't know what people think of it. It's very, like, very ethereal and kind of dreamy.
It's good. You know? I got to see the band in Halifax last October, and it was really wonderful. And I liked it. And then you've got, and Jen is great. I was trying to say that Jen's a lovely singer. She's a lovely person.
Yeah, she's awesome, and I think she should be way more well known than she is. And I don't know. I think I'm really surprised that she's not like super well known. So I don't know if this project that we're doing is kind of maybe not going to be like the most commercial thing that she's done. You know, so I don't know if it's necessarily going to. Raise her profile that way, but hopefully like people see, oh, she's like got these really cool lyrics and she's got a wicked voice, she can really sing. And so
I feel like, for you know, I know what you're saying. I think on a sort of underground to middle ground level, she had a pretty good profile there for a while, and she still does. But, I mean, I know she recently left the label she was on or something.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think there was a bunch of changes like that, too. But I went and saw her band play at the Marquee, and it was like this. It kind of reminded me of like something like this, that, you know, how like a band like Wilco are like really popular and they're cool, but they're kind of accessible but neat, you know.
Yeah,
that's kind of what her stuff reminds me of. It's like, you know, I mean, maybe it's just like where you are, like having to tour. I mean, she tours a fair amount too, so I hopefully, you know, in the future people will kind of know more about what she does. And
yeah,
She's really creative too, like genuinely creative, you know, like not like into the craft of, nothing wrong with being into the craft of songwriting, but she's not doing it because, like, you know, she's not kind of doing, she doesn't want to get in a room in Nashville or whatever. Like, she's trying to do something that's actually imaginative. So I respect that, you know, like someone who's coming from a place that's kind of genuinely creative as opposed to craftsperson like.
Yeah, and she's got a great spirit about her, too. I mean, I think I think she's great. I'm glad you guys are working together because I'd say she's one of my favorite people. You're one of my favorite people. It's good. And the band is good. I enjoyed seeing it. I can't wait to hear the whole record. You mentioned earlier that Josh is like a musical encyclopedia, but I kind of think of you as a bit of a musical encyclopedia on many levels. You know a lot about music, too, right? You've sort of studied it.
Well, yeah, kind of. I mean, it's almost like if you don't really have, I'm not even saying I have a lot of aptitude in music, but it was a thing that I really got kind of hooked into, you know? And that's probably what it just kind of, if you look at my bookshelf, it's kind of sad. There's like, I don't really read novels anymore. My wife makes fun of me because it's all like rock books. It's like, how many books about Jimi Hendrix can you read really, you know, like, I don't know, I've probably owned like 7 of them or something. So it's kind of this nerdy kind of scholarship aspect to it too. That's like, and a lot of the stuff too is like, who knows if, it's very, Rashomon? It's very Rashomon, you know, what actually happened? You never really know. Right?
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. Totally.
There's an awesome book I read recently though about, it's David Todd. This guy David Todd wrote this book called Feeding Back, and it's like one of the best music books I've ever read. It's really, really inspiring. It's like he's interviewing all these different guitar players, but they're all like weird guitar players. So it's like Tom Verlaine, Richard Thompson, Johnny Marr, Lee Ronaldo, Glenn Branca, just a bunch of weird guitar players talking about guitars, like from a different perspective of like learning like blues scales and stuff. Is a great, if you're a guitar player, it's like really, really good. I totally recommend that book. It's kind of hard to find, I think, but it's called Feeding Back. Stuff like that, you know, like that's a really worthwhile. Like sometimes it's just like recounting facts and, you know, oh, Jimi Hendrix arrived in London and, you know, this day, and then he went over to so-and-so's house to jam. Like that's all like just facts, but this book actually has like a lot of information that's really insightful, you know?
Yeah, no, that sounds cool. Do you and this sounds, and this maybe going to take you aback a little bit, but do you remember who published this book?
I could find out. It's in my house right now and I'm in my backyard, but I don't know if I should go in there. And
no, it's not that big a deal. I just, because you the other, like a little while ago, you were trying to urge me to write a book about people.
Yeah, man.
What was the premise again? You're like just people who did it, who like worked on
Chronicles of Failure.
People who, it was like Born to Lose or something, and it was just like this idea of like chronicling all these people who make music no matter what the odds are against them. And I thought it was kind of interesting, but I was also like, I'm at a point where I'm like, well, who's the audience for that? Who am I going to get to convince to put out this book? And
Yeah, it's funny because, like, you and I are both convinced that a certain individual is, like, a major, major artist, but most people, if you say that to them, they go, like, who's that?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, you know, in the case of, like, Al Tuck, I mean, I think he's a major, major songwriter. Like, I don't really know anyone who's better working today. Like, I'm not just, like, I know him and stuff like that, but I would... I don't know if I would have found out about him if I didn't know him, or, you know, if I didn't mm-hmm. live where I live. So
you introduced me. You literally introduced me to him in like 1995. We were at this was at the Volcano in Kitchener, and which is an infamous show. But basically, the Super Friends went on a little headlining tour, and you brought Al with you, and maybe the local Rabbits or somebody. I can't remember, but. Definitely you and Al, and Al opened, and I met him, and I picked up a couple of the records that he had for sale, but his guitarist at the time,
Clive McNutt, yeah.
Clive McNutt had a nervous breakdown on stage and like destroyed his guitar, and it was really ugly and strange, and I didn't know what was going on, and I was 18 or something, and I was like, what the hell is going on?
Yeah, well, that was an ill-fated trip for that band, for the Tuck. It was like all the bad things happened to them, and then on that tour and all the, and so, and it was kind of, we took kind of like a, almost like a bit of a, not a sadistic pleasure, but it was amusing to a certain point that, you know, things, it was kind of, they weren't really a band. It was kind of like Al and a bunch of guys that he had kind of assembled. So it was like them, in a van, you know, it was kind of ramshackle, and they're all really good musicians. That like that's the thing too. Like Clive's a phenomenal guitar player and keyboard player. So, and he's still going, and he's still around, and he's doing a lot better than he was that particular day. So.
Yeah, he was going through like a personal situation, and it just came out on stage. Basically, I mean, were you not playing in the band with Al?
Well, Yeah, I think that was because Clive wasn't around to play the show, so I sat in, and
I thought you were on stage when this meltdown was happening. Maybe I'm wrong.
That might have been, yeah. It's all like it really like 1995. Like it's like it. That probably is true, but it's, like it's all Rashomon thing, right? It's like different multiple viewpoints. Like sometimes Drew tells these stories about these tours, and I'm like. Was I there? Like the way I remember it was complete, you know, it's just like anything is you get these different viewpoints and you get like 20 years on it and it's just, oh, okay.
Yeah.
You know, so it's pretty interesting that way. And I mean like classic thing with Al, like, I mean, you could see like one of the best shows you've ever seen and you could see something that was like a kind of went pear-shaped or something, but it's always going to be interesting. But you know, you talk to different people, say, oh yeah, the best show I ever saw was, you know, Al Tuck solo with the, you know, blah blah blah, and then some will say that was the worst show I ever saw, you know. So there's no absolutes in rock and roll.
Exactly. I do think it was a good idea, and maybe I'll explore it. I mean, yeah, it's interesting that just kind of applying kind of scholarship to music is always interesting, because I, you know, so many music books, and I always wonder what the audience is for it. And for a while there, I was like, I got to get out of this. All I've done is music. But you know, maybe that's for a reason. I mean, I'm obviously fully immersed in it. So,
well, it kind of it's a very what's the word? Like when it gets you, like it's unfortunate. You know, like I kind of. Today I was joking. I was playing the guitar, and I said to the guy I was working with, "It's like guitar. I wish I never met you. I might be an accountant now, or something like that." You know, it's like it kind of consumes you, and then it kind of you might not even be that good, but you're gonna get sucked into it. You know, like it's almost like if you don't work at it, you know, you won't be any good. And even if you work at it a lot, you still might not end up being that good. So it's not something I recommend, you know. Like I remember the Good Brothers had a joke where if they wanted their kids to be musicians, they'd hang the instruments high on the wall and say, don't touch them, you know?
Right.
So, you know, if you, and with the case of my kids, I'm definitely not like, you know, my daughter's getting pretty into the flute, but it's not like I'm like, hey, yeah, the flute is you should really focus on the flute exclusively, you know?
Well, it's funny you say that, because like this afternoon I went to look at a tiny, my kid's going to be three next week, and he is currently, as much as like he has, you know, cognitive abilities and all that, like he's a pretty smart kid, he seems to know what he likes, but he's a kid, and like I feel like up to 20 years old, it's nothing but phases, but he is currently into music, and he likes it a lot. And whenever he sees a drum kit, he wants to play a drum kit. Whenever he sees a guitar, he wants to play the guitar. So this afternoon, I went and looked at a tiny mini drum kit.
I think drums, yeah, why not, too, because you get, like, there's something to kind of, like, bash and...
I was thinking of it as a coordination thing almost. Even if he ends up hating them, you gotta. Yeah. There's a certain amount of coordination you pick up just figuring out how to hit drums.
No, I think that'd be awesome. And I mean, you want to kind of give, like, it's more like you want to offer him like different possibilities, and you're not going to be like down there with a metronome. Well, I don't know.
No, I won't. I'm not being that serious about it. Like, that's the thing. Like,
yeah.
I wanted to get him a kit, and then to be honest, my parents were like, "What should we get? What should we get him for his birthday?" And I was like, "Well, we just got him a little tiny bicycle, which was, you know, that's something he needed to figure out. Like, he was riding around at the department store, and we're like, well, he seems to got the hang of it. So there's that." But I was, you know, for a little while thinking of getting him a little tiny drum kit, and they were like, okay. So I went and looked at it. It's like a little tiny, tiny Ludwig drum kit. It's not that much. It's not that much money, but
is the hardware good? Like, does it look like it could withstand the pummeling of a tree?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't at all. But I do think, like, what am I doing? I just figure I'll give him the shot, and then if he wants, you're right. I'm treating it like a toy. It's like an elaborate toy, and if he gets into it. No pressure. I don't care. Like, if he doesn't like them, it's fine. But so far, everything points to him liking it. So I'm getting him a thing he likes currently. And then at some point, your kids are older than three, so you probably have seen them go through, like, I really, 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 really want this. And then you get it for them, and they're like, I don't want it anymore.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. And the musical taste, like, this might sound like a downer, but I found, like, with my kids, before they had all the kind of, I don't know, I want to say like societal pressure, like they're getting marketed to pretty insanely, and it's more video based, right?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
it's not really, they're not really getting, music isn't getting marketed to them so much as videos, right? So, and they're really targeted hard. So, I mean, my older daughter used to be in like Queens of the Stone Age when she was like four.
Right.
But now she's, you know, and then once she kind of got her peer group, then she kind of, you know, they love everything until the peer group kind of dictates that that's not cool or that's outside of a, I mean, maybe your guy will be like, you know, who knows, you know, there's always exceptions.
No, I totally, it's fine. Right now, it's totally what it is. And I didn't know this was going to happen, but right now, like his favorite bands are, like the Ramones and the Replacements, and that's what he likes. Like, that's the songs he knows. Pavement, he loves Pavement. Yeah, it's awesome, but I also know that it's a window. It's going to close, and what I'm trying to do is just enjoy this while I can.
Because
the reason it happened was he just wanted to listen to the Wiggles, which is like a kids group, right? And so we'd listen to it, and eventually I was like, I can't handle this anymore. Can we put on something?
They don't have a lot of ideas. Like, they're kind of a one-trick pony, eh? The old Wiggles.
Yeah, a little bit. So it became a thing where I'm like, hey, do you want to try listening to something else? And he's currently at an age where, you know, he might resist, but he looks up to us and wants to be involved in the things that we like. So I just gradually was like, I want to listen to the Replacements in the car. And he just liked it because it was Papa was telling him an idea of a thing he could like. And I wasn't like, you have to like this. You know, he'll still make requests for that Pharrell song, Happy. You know that song?
From
the soundtrack to some movie? I can't
remember. Catchy.
Yeah. So he's still...
it's catchy.
There's that stuff, but I'm just trying to get, you know, some stuff in there too. That's all it is. So,
yeah. And I mean, in a weird kind of way, the Ramones are like the ultimate children's band, but kids just don't know it. You know, like...
Yeah, exactly. Like
he's
walking around the same way he was with the Wiggles. He's like, Papa, you're Joey. Gary, the cat, is Dee Dee. I'm, you know, like he's going around talking about how we're all the Ramones. I'm Johnny, Mama's, you know, he's just doing it. And it's amazing. Like they look like characters and they act like kind of cartoon characters. So I think that's a big revelation. If we've taught anyone anything today, it's that if you have small children, introduce them to the Ramones.
Yeah, and I mean, like, something like Beat on the Brat, that message doesn't have to be taken literally either, although...
The first record is questionable for kids, I would say. Like, if it gets to a point where he asked me what 53rd and 3rd is about, which is a song chronicling Dee Dee's experiences as a male prostitute, you know, if he actually asked me those questions, it'll be a difficult conversation. But right now, he thinks the lyrics and the chorus really is puppy, bird, and bird.
Maybe this is like something that maybe you got to re-record like a bunch of Ramones tunes with, you know, puppy, bird, and bird. That's, yeah, that could.
That's pretty cool.
That's better than the Wiggles. Yeah.
Anyway, it's an interesting thing. Now, you grew up, like I was rereading a thing I wrote about the Super Friends not too long ago. And Drew Yamada, your bandmate in the Super Friends, suggests that you were one of the catalysts for him discovering bands like Meat Puppets and The Replacements, and you liked Uncle Tupelo, mostly American bands. Like, you got into kind of that college rock situation. How did you get into that stuff?
It was just probably not having too much else to do, and then you start kind of researching, like, you know, maybe just wanting to be, who knows? I mean, who really knows? But I mean, I remember hearing, because I lived in, you know, grew up in Toronto, and I remember hearing the Meat Puppets on college radio or whatever, and like this crazy, sounded like it was from another planet, you know, and then just kind of really, and it's also maybe it was like, okay, well, this is different, and this is something I can kind of like find out on my own, and it's not, you know, most of my friends were listening to like AC/DC, which I was kind of into or whatever, but there was some, you know, it didn't really speak to the alienated youth that I was. You know what I mean? They were like talking about stuff that was more, you know, I could relate to, like Husker Du, like the lyrics and stuff. I could really,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you're like, everything's so serious when you're a teenager. And it's like, you know, The Replacements, especially, like, I mean, the lyrics were really, really important to me. I don't know, like, just what he was talking about, I could relate to it. And it was really important to me. Like, I can't really overstate how important it was. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was that kind of thing. And then it was like, okay, like, a sense of humor too, which was really weird and kind of quirky in a lot of that stuff, especially the Meat Puppets. What I liked about them too, they were just really weird and kind of arty, and, but they're also like good, really good players. I don't know. It's just like a whole bunch of things about it that I found really, like, that was the best. I think that was the best stuff being made then, right?
Yeah, no. Yeah.
Maybe there's stuff being made in England that was really good too, or in. But I mean, the stuff that the best music in the '80s was all underground. It was completely ignored by, you know, most of it anyway. I mean, any kind of like rock music was completely ignored by mainstream radio until. You know, until I was older, until like we're, you know, by the time Nirvana came around, it was like, it wasn't like, oh, this band sounds really different. It was more like, oh, they sound like, you know, Soul Asylum with better production or whatever.
Right.
You know, I mean, it was already, the groundwork had been laid by all those other bands like Dinosaur and, you know, the Pixies or whatever, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, but that stuff was really, really good. And it was, a lot of it was really like rattly recorded too, which is, you know, some of my favorite stuff. Really sounds weird now when you listen, like Husker Du records sound insane.
Mm-hmm.
But the content, it kind of, what is the content kind of outshines the that make sense?
Yeah. Like it kind of transcends the medium in which it was captured.
Yeah,
I guess.
Yeah. So,
okay. So, those bands, like, I mean, you kind of sounded like you had an underground. You had an appreciation for not only underground but sort of underdogs on some level. Where did that kind of get instilled within you as a young man? Like, were you? What made you? What prompted you to seek out these bands that were ultimately being ignored by most of the mainstream press?
Well, you never know. It could just be like trying to be different or whatever. By being like, if you have the stance of like not of being in, you know, as a teenager, you're going to be in opposition to. A lot of things. So, if you're kind of got a healthy, imagination or whatever. So, I don't know. I don't want to read too much into it, but it was just more like stuff that was underappreciated maybe a little bit.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I mean, in the case of someone like Taka, like, I find, like, the more time I spend in the working in the quote-unquote, like, the fringes of the music industry, it's like I'm realizing more and more it's the people who are really organized get ahead. I mean, it's not necessarily about being an artist all the time, right? So I think with some, one thing I liked about a lot of these bands is that the artistry was kind of, seemed like the artistry. Maybe it wasn't, but to me it seemed like the artistry was kind of first.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I mean, now, I mean, we're basically creating a, or not we, but the, whatever the kids there now are getting, like, as far as I, like, there's got to be some band that's got to come along and kind of, there's got to be something to come along in the next few years that, I mean, what kids are into and what they're getting, what they're, what's getting marketed to them is, you know, if there's any, it's worse than the 80s in a lot of respects, I think.
Yeah.
Especially for, like, guitar-based music, it's crazy bad, you know, in the mainstream sense, so.
Yeah, but, yeah, I'd have to agree with you. I mean, at some point, you started playing with Drew. You know, all of these bands, all of this sort of, all of these ideas kind of informing what you wanted to do as a songwriter yourself. But when you started with Drew, you were mostly kind of playing like kind of acoustic guitar together, right?
Oh, me personally?
Yeah, like weren't the two of you kind of just trading off on acoustic guitars?
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, like, what happened, you know, when I was 12, the week my parents got divorced, I got an electric guitar, so you can kind of put two and two, you know what I mean?
Hmm.
So then I had an acoustic guitar too, but it was like, that was kind of like the main thing through high school. And then there was a bit of that strummy coffee house type of stuff going on for a while, but we weren't really listening to that kind of music, except for Neil Young, who can do no wrong, right?
Yeah.
We weren't really listening to a lot of acoustic stuff. And Uncle Tupelo, I guess, a bit. But, yeah, that was more probably because we weren't allowed. I think the first year I met him, we were, like, in a dormitory, so at King's, right? So we tried to jam once with electric stuff. And then the next year when everybody moved out and had, like, apartments, I had a basement where we could jam. And then that's when we started this band, Rhinoplasty, which was more like a kind of really bad. No, it wasn't bad, but it was like a kind of grungy, kind of garagey band.
Right.
Yeah. But the acoustic thing, I think, might have been more like of necessity than, I don't know. I don't want to be too revisionist here, but I don't think the acoustic component of it was just like, yeah, this is all we can do right now.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. I just knew that you guys were starting to trade off songs before you met Matt, and then it became kind of a trio of people trading off songs. And then it seems like from that, like a natural offshoot of that relatively quiet collaboration was to form a band when you had the ability to make noise. But the fact that you all had your own voices in the band, you know, I was talking to Monomyth about this the other day. As I said, they were on the show and we were talking about Halifax and the kind of bands that seem to represent this musical democracy. Was this an intentional thing? Was this an offshoot of what was going on in your community where most bands seem to have multiple singers and multiple songwriters?
I guess to a degree, but I really think that there's a real lack of awareness and a real lack of calculation with a lot of that stuff. And it was probably like, well, he's got songs and I got songs and I need people to play mine. And you know, it was a lot of that. I think it wasn't kind of like, we're going to be a trio, like, or, you know, it's going to be like the Beatles. It was more like, I just want to get this stuff out there. And by any means, you could, you know, so you kind of, I mean, the best analogy I thought for the Super Friends, somebody wrote an article once saying it was like Breaking Away. It was like that, like, this was a movie about the cyclists, like the kind of like gang of rejects who got together. And that, it was like, we were kind of like, we weren't, you know, we were kind of like, didn't have, we played with, Matt and I played with Tuck a bit, and but it was like, we didn't have our own band. We were just like, shit, like, we got to do something. We got to, you know, we just felt like our lives were passing us by with all our friends were in these bands like Sloan or, you know, jail and stuff. They were doing like a lot of, it was all around the same time. It was kind of blurry, but it was more like we were just like, shit, we gotta get off our asses and like actually do something. It was more that kind of, it was kind of, and I mean, the common ground was fairly wide, but there's also a lot of aspects to it that weren't like, there wasn't a lot of commonality about some things, you know? So, but the thing we all agree on is we really like the Kinks and, you know,
television.
Yeah, television. Yeah, those two. It was pretty much what we were. So that kind of guitar interplay, two guitar interplay. Mm-hmm. But you know, but really lack of calculation, like really, really not clued out. Like we were all kind of thought about stuff, but we didn't think about it like as a conceptually, you know.
Yeah. No, I hear you. It just sort of happened the way it happened, and it just kept going and. And so we're kind of here now, and that's just the way it sort of ended up. I do want to ask about your production work, because at some point you got more into making records and that aspect of things. Earlier you were talking about how much you appreciated the sound of some records that meant a lot to you. How did you end up actually getting into being a producer, an engineer?
Well, it was really kind of out of honestly, it was kind of like, you know, being in the band and then just at the end of it kind of being like, well, I want to stay involved working on records. And I've always been doing like forward tracking and all that stuff and just looking at a way to keep involved without having to tour too much. And also kind of a desperation, like I was back at the same kind of dishwashing job when I started playing in the band or whatever. 3 years later, I was back in the same player. 4 years later, exactly where I started, I was like, shit, like,
yeah,
I got to do something. So it was the same kind of thing, like not very calculated and pretty, you know, maybe there's a bit of a pattern emerging,
But that requires a certain skill set. Like, did you just learn from making records yourself? Like, I mean, like of other people sort of like,
I still got a lot to learn, but I mean, I had a lot to learn even, I started doing like home recording and then we had like an 8-track machine with the Super Friends. But I took me a long time to, and I don't really feel, you know, obviously like that's a whole other discipline that is really, you know, it's something that, I feel like I'm kind of got a clue, but you know, compared to, it's just more like I wanted to stay involved in making records, and maybe if I couldn't be the dude playing the instruments all the time, at least I could help people and not get in the way of what people are trying to do. That was kind of my thing. It was like I was sometimes frustrated working on records where it was like someone telling me I couldn't do this thing, and I was like, well, I just want to try this, and they were like, well, no, that's sonically impossible or whatever, you know what I mean? Like, he got that a lot in the 80s, kind of late 80s, early 90s, like you can't do that.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? So that was kind of like the idea of like not being a barrier to other people's, but then you kind of as you get into it more, you realize like 10 years later, it's like, yeah, that is kind of sonically impossible, or there's a reason why a lot of studios look like dentist's office, because it, you know, everything has to be so organized, and my place is kind of like a junk heap, and I'm like, oh man, I wish I'd gone about this differently and was more organized, you know? But it's more about just trying to staying involved and just trying to make stuff, you know, stuff that excites you and the people, you know. But in a lot of cases, like now, I mean, say like a band like Monomyth, they'll come in and do like their basic tracks at the studio and then they'll go and mess around with it at home for like 2 months and then they'll come back and like finish it. But the creative process, like with home recording stuff, is like can really happen within the band now a lot more than 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So, you know, like it's not, they're not, you know, they can make stuff that sounds really cool and mess around. And then, so that's kind of the thing that's neat. It's like, that wasn't really an option as much, unless it was all 4-tracks, like early 90s stuff was definitely all 4-track stuff. So you had certain limitations, like, which were cool in themselves, but not for everything, you know, like not everyone's guided by voices, like not everyone can make a masterpiece on a 4-track. So,
right. Well, speaking of masterpieces, Mock-Up Scale Down came out. I consider it a masterpiece. It got a lot of love when it came out. It got a lot of love with the reissue recently. Are you happy with how things turned out with the double vinyl? I know it showed up late, but otherwise, are you pleased to have it on vinyl?
Yeah, no, I think it turned out awesome. Yeah, I mean, that was really, I know I've talked to you about this a bunch, but Brendan McGuire, the guy who actually engineered that record, like, if anything, he was kind of like making sure we didn't do anything too stupid. So he was really, really instrumental. So yeah, probably one of the reasons it turned out really well because of that guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, with the, like, I don't know if people know much about that Brendan McGuire guy. Like, people maybe don't hear that name a lot, but he was pretty important to recording a lot of those bands around here. He was Sloan's sound guy for a while too.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. He was Sloan's sound guy and he made records for them. And I mean, there's a whole saga of even how he came about recording your band for the first time. It's a great record and I'm glad it came out again, but I do want to ask you about the status of the Super Friends generally. You're playing this one single show. There have been rumors that there's a forgotten or lost record that has yet to be completed. What's going on with the band?
Oh, well, you know, it's just people not having, it's hard to find the time. It really is, you know, like, and Matt Murphy lives in Toronto and Drew is a doctor and we're all, you know, everyone's really, schedules are really busy. So we started working on something about 5 years ago and I still have those bed tracks. I think Matt in particular, like kind of his songs, he wasn't super psyched on at the time and he might have like started them or something. But there's a couple things that were pretty cool. But the dynamic was different. Like, I think the one thing that was cool about the mock-up thing is like you got the songs really tight or pretty tight and then you went and banged them out, you know?
Yeah.
And now like not being like a band where you practice and then you play shows and then you go and record. Like it's a studio as an instrument kind of opens up a can of worms that's kind of hard to close sometimes, right?
Yeah.
Like if you listen to mock-up, scale down, it's like two guitars, bass and drums, pretty much that's it. And that's probably one of the things that like the minimalist aspect to it is something that makes it pretty cool.
Yeah.
And it's hard to work with those kind of, I don't know. This is just my take on it. It's just really hard to keep things that focused when you're not a working band. So that, I think the stuff like the songs are probably really cool, but you know, guitar parts that might take like 2 months to write in jams. You can't just write parts that good.
Yeah.
10 minutes, or maybe you can, I don't know, but I don't know. That's just my take on it. Like it's just hard to keep that momentum going.
So it would take a minor miracle for the Super Friends to become like an active, fully active band at this point.
Well, my mom, you know, I think that's pretty unlikely, but it'd be great. It'd be fun to play. I was pushing to play more shows, but I'm kind of more for I probably don't have anything better to do than to play shows. Whereas some other guys might have, you know, they've got like real careers. I'm kind of like just always doing like music stuff. That's not, and with Marsh too, Marsh is kind of like a real working musician. So he's always interested in doing stuff, but it's more like he's got commitments to doing Joel stuff. And,
yeah,
so it's definitely really, it's really different, you know, like the cliche, you know, it's like, it's just hard to like old timers hockey, like, you know, it is literally old timers hockey. Like, are you going to, you can get to the ice like once every few weeks or something like that, but you can't get to the ice like every night.
Yeah. It's too bad, but I mean, I'm glad you're going to be playing Guelph and I want to tell people that, as I say, the Super Friends playing the Hillside Festival in Guelph on Saturday, July 26th. Tickets for that day are actually all sold out, but you can still buy tickets for Friday and Sunday at hillsidefestival.ca. And you can learn more about the Super Friends at thesuperfriends.tumblr.com. I think that's the best place, right, Charles?
Yeah, that's an amazing website. So I guess I'll see you on Sunday too, so we can have a chat.
Yeah,
have
yeah.
A laugh,
we can
for
have
sure.
We can have a laugh. Is there a song we can play by the Super Friends right now for people to hear?
Yeah, have you got any of those like weird rarities or anything like that?
I might have some. You could probably send me some. You want to send me something?
Yeah, I can probably find some digs up. There's like a rarities thing on the internet that's like MP3s of these tunes. There's a couple of tunes that are kind of cool. That there's a couple of songs, like some of the, like that Matt Murphy song, Mountaineer.
Yeah.
And there's a song that Drew's called Over My Head that's kind of a cool song. Like it has a, it's kind of country-ish almost, but it's a neat tune. There's a bunch of songs that were kind of neat near the end that we never really recorded properly, but there's like these kind of bootleggy things.
Which one do you want to play? Like, do you have an idea of which one you'd want to play right now?
There's that Mountaineer song. It's a cool song. You probably find that pretty easily.
All right, well, that sounds good. Let's go with that. Let's go with that. We'll go with Mountaineer by the Super Friends. And Charles, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. I wish you the best of luck with everything, and I'm going to see you really soon.
Cheers.
It's the new one. It's called Mountaineer. One, two, three, four.
Thanks again for checking out Creative Control with Vish Khanna. You can email me about the show at creativecontrol933@gmail.com. That's creative with a K, control with a K, 933@gmail.com. You can also follow our Twitter at Vish Creative, VishKreative. And you can also like our Facebook page. A version of this show airs on CFRU in Guelph every Wednesday at noon Eastern. And you can listen to that online at CFRU.ca, or if you're in the KW region at 93.3 FM in Guelph. You can also sign up for the weekly mailing list for the podcast and the show at vishkana.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. I believe that is everything I wanted to tell you. Thank you once again.